Liz Norell teaches political science at Chattanooga State Community College. She is sharing her knowledge of how government on all levels works in a virtual series of classes now underway, hosted by the Chattery. Liz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
What a time to host a series of classes on civics.
Well, and to be honest, we scheduled this because we know that the elections are coming up and people are even more interested in them than usual. And we specifically designed this series so that it will finish just before or just as early voting starts in Tennessee, so that people who are preparing to vote can feel more educated about doing so.
You've had one class already. Tell us more about that.
The first class, which was just a few days ago, was an overview of how we run elections in the United States. We started with primaries and caucuses and then talked about the Electoral College, just to get a sense of the way that those are structured. We had a really good discussion about some of the potential unintended consequences if we were to just get rid of the Electoral College.
What's one unintended consequence?
Just to be clear, this is all speculation because nobody really knows what would happen because it's never happened. But my suspicion is that in a world without an Electoral College, we would see much, much more money being pumped into presidential elections because the candidates would have to campaign in very expensive media markets where currently they don't have to, like New York, like Houston, like Chicago. We sort of assume that those markets, we know how they're going to vote. And so there's no need to run very expensive ads in those markets. So one of the things that I worry about is in a world without an Electoral College, we see exponentially more money involved, which is not something that I'm super excited about personally.
And at the same time, we have received an education about the Electoral College at work in more than one election in the past generation where the candidate who prevailed in the Electoral College did not win the popular vote.
Quite true. And, you know, that's something that I think has, for many people, created some interesting ideas about why the Electoral College was created the way it was that are perhaps not particularly grounded in the historical record of why we have an Electoral College. I remember after the 2016 election being at a restaurant. So I live in Monteagle and I was at a local restaurant and I heard some people at the next table talking about how the Electoral College was created to make sure that people who lived in cities didn't overrule people who lived in rural communities. And I thought, well, that's a very nice post hoc justification, but it's not particularly well grounded in the historical record.
The next class that you have coming up is on gerrymandering.
Gerrymandering, or if you want to be persnickety about it, gerrymandering, because of course gerrymandering comes from a man named Elbridge Gerry in New England, who was one of the pioneers in drawing districts to predispose electoral outcomes in his favor. So this class will talk about what redistricting is and how that process works, and what gerrymandering is and how it's just a particular kind of redistricting.
And this is particularly important now because we have been talking about the census, and it is the information from the census that leads to the drawing of legislative districts, of congressional districts, and gerrymandering is an abuse of that process.
Well, I might quibble with the use of the word abuse. It is one particular kind of use. It's certainly not illegal, and everybody does it on both sides. So I'm not sure that it's an improper use, but I think when people learn about it, many Americans feel like it's probably not the way we want our districts to be drawn.
And then the next class that you have, and then after the class on gerrymandering, you have a class on Chattanooga and Hamilton County government. And we've talked a little bit about this before.
Yeah, so we're going to do three different workshops that look at different levels of government. We've got one on local, and that one we really talk about the difference between city versus county government and how they work together and how they have different responsibilities. And, you know, in that one, we get a lot of questions about which government does what and what are we electing people to do on our behalf. So that one's really fun because we often get a lot of people at those workshops, the local government ones, who actually have some experience working for local government. And that's fun for me because I get to hear the perspective of people who are actually working in government.
And we saw the differences between city government and county government in the past few months in the response to COVID-19 and the debate about mask mandates and who had the final say on guidelines.
Not only did we see some discrepancy between city and county, we saw some differences between elected officials with independent spheres of authority at the same level of government. So we had Hamilton County Mayor Jim Coppinger requiring masks, but then the sheriff not enforcing that and local police feeling like they had to try to decide which side they were on. And so, yeah, that all comes down to local politics and local spheres of influence. And that's really fascinating.
And that leads us to the class after that, which is about state of Tennessee government.
I want to kind of link back to something we were just talking about on gerrymandering. It is the state legislature that will oversee and approve districting maps. And this has a profound impact on so many parts of our lives. So the state government, I think, is especially important for us to be paying attention to as we go into the November election this year, because the people that we elect will be the ones who will oversee the redistricting process next year.
And from what has been reported, it seems that Tennessee will retain the same number of representatives in the U.S. House, but still, how are those districts drawn? And the same goes for districts in the General Assembly.
That's exactly right. I don't know if we have specific numbers yet to know exactly what the number of congressional seats will be, but I don't expect there to be big changes for Tennessee. But you're absolutely right. The state legislature draws congressional districts, but also state house districts, county commission districts. All of those different redistricting plans go through the state legislature for approval. And so they're largely drawn by local people, but they have to go through an approval process. And so the stakes of those state elections are just incredibly important in any election, but especially in elections in years that end in zero, like this year.
And what happens in Tennessee will not happen in a vacuum, because some of our neighbors have seen changes and will see more changes unfold in their demographics. I'm thinking of North Carolina. I'm thinking of Georgia, and how the same process for drawing districts in those states may impact what lawmakers in Tennessee decide to do.
That's right. And in North Carolina, especially in the last cycle, they have been through several rounds of lawsuits related to decisions that that state's legislature made around the drawing of districts. And in 2010, there was some discussion, I don't know how serious it was, but there was some discussion in the Tennessee legislature about doing some fairly radical shifts in the drawing of districts for Tennessee, such that the constituencies in Shelby County, which is Memphis, and in Davidson County, which is Nashville, were more spread out, so that the two Democrats who serve in the Tennessee delegation of the House might have a harder time winning those seats. That was eventually shot down, and those two seats remain largely districted such that Democrats can be competitive and, in fact, have continued to hold those seats. But there's no guarantee that the state legislature would continue to do that.
And then we have the final class in October on the federal government.
Yes. And one of the things that I like to focus on in that particular class is what the powers of the presidency are, but perhaps just as importantly, what the powers of the presidency are not. And thinking about some of the myths that we have around what the president can and cannot do, that's some of the most interesting content for my students at Chat State and also for the people in that particular workshop. So that's always a fun conversation.
What's something that most people may not know about the real powers of the presidency or the Congress or the Supreme Court that they should know?
One thing that I always like to stress, and this is something of a personal crusade of mine, is that we tend to think that the president has a lot more control over the economy than I would argue he does. It is true that the president has some very limited discretion over a small amount of spending, and the president, through his words, can influence the general level of trust of Americans in the state of the economy. But in terms of actually having access to the levers that control our economy, the president has very little. And this is something that kind of gets me worked up no matter who's in the Oval Office and what they're claiming. People who today want to credit Trump for a great economy are just as infuriating to me as people who criticized George W. Bush for being president during a downturn in the economy. Because the truth is, neither of those presidents has really earned the blame or the credit for what the economy is doing.
A portion of the proceeds from all the classes in this series will go to Chattanooga State's First in the Family Scholarship. Tell us more about that.
At Chattanooga State, we have a large number of students who are first-generation college students. This is a population that's near and dear to my heart because they sit in my classes and they're often people who don't have role models in their life who can help them navigate college. And so choosing to donate my time for these workshops so that we can provide more scholarship dollars for that particular population is very important to me. So these students apply for scholarships. We also have an annual fundraiser. This is a big initiative of Chat State to make college more accessible and affordable to first generation college students. So I'm happy that a portion of what we earn from these workshops will go to support those scholarships.
And all of these classes that you are teaching through the Chattery online have a suggested donation of $10. A portion of the proceeds, as we've been saying, go to Chattanooga State's First in the Family Scholarship. And for people who want more information and want to participate, they can go to thechattery.org. If people want to connect with you beyond the classes, how can they reach you?
The best way is probably just to email me, and my email address has an obnoxiously large number of letters in it, but it's elizabeth.norell, and my last name is spelled N-O-R-E-L-L at chattanoogastate.edu. And I welcome questions anytime. I really see my job as bringing more information about how government works to everyone, including the people in my classroom. So if listeners have questions, please reach out anytime.
All right, Liz, thanks so much.
I appreciate it, Ray. Thank you.